It is good to see everybody here this morning. It is recorded in the Gospels that the disciples of Jesus occasionally had a hard time understanding the concept of greatness. Let's begin in Mark chapter 9 and notice a couple verses out of Mark chapter 9, namely verses 33 and 34. Mark 9, beginning in verse 33. And when they came to Capernaum, when he was in the house, he began to question his disciples. "What were you discussing on the way here?" Now they kept silent, it says in verse 34, for on the way they had discussed with one another which one of them was the greatest. Now, that's not the only time that they have a hard time understanding the concept of greatness. So also have your Bibles open to Mark 10, go a page over and consider that here in just a few minutes. The disciples' minds were so tempered by the culture around them, as minds tend to be. They had a very difficult time accepting the oxymoron that Jesus would preach here in Mark chapter 10, that greatness is found in service to others and in humility of mind. I would interject here, of course, that we have just as difficult a time as the disciples do. And so as we study this story in Mark 10, please be aware, I'm not saying this to criticize the disciples or to think little of them. I believe that if I were in their same shoes, that I might have the same trouble that they did. The only reason I say that is because I am in their same shoes at times. I feel like today our own culture promotes an idea of greatness that is not unlike the culture of the Gentiles in the first century. Greatness is found in lording it over people. Greatness is found in how many people are subject to you. Greatness is found in how many people you step on along the way to get to the high perch from which you watch the world around you. So let's notice here a story in Mark chapter 10 along these same lines of greatness. There's a parallel account, of course, in Matthew chapter 20 and also in Luke chapter 22. So we're going to notice a few details along the way from the Matthew 20 and Luke 22 account. So just be aware that if we mention some details that aren't necessarily in Mark 10, when you look at a composite of all three of those accounts, you get the full picture. So that being said, it does say in Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse 35, that James and John, and as Matthew's account says in Matthew 20, really their mother came with them as well and was the first one to speak up, as mothers tend to with the sons that they're proud of. But James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, came up to him, saying to Jesus, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." Up until this point, that might not be any kind of an issue. My kids ask me for stuff all day long, and I'm happy to help them with whatever it is they can't reach or whatever it is they can't open or whatever it is they can't operate on their own. And Jesus said to them in verse 36, "What do you want me to do for you?" Though we all know that Jesus is aware of the hearts of all men. He knows what they're going to ask for. He knows what is on the mind of the mother of the sons of Zebedee right now as they all come up and are asking Jesus, "We'd like a favor, if you don't mind, just a little favor that you can do for us." Jesus already knows. And yet he gives them the benefit of the doubt and allows them to ask the question that he already knows is coming. In verse 37, they said to him, "Grant that we may sit in your glory, one on your right and one on your left." It would be tradition, of course, in this culture, as it is in many cultures, that great men would have their counselors and their closest friends and advisors sit on either side of them in their throne room. And so what John and James are asking is no different than what a lot of their contemporaries were already asking. Herod had his best friends who would sit next to him. Caesar had his best friends that would sit next to him. And the seat at the right hand or the left hand of a truly great man was a place of incredible honor. And that's all they're asking. Maybe in their own minds they've sort of justified it like, you know, we've been with you from basically the beginning. Okay, we've been with you through thick and thin. As Peter put it at one point, we've given up everything. In Matthew chapter 19, we've given up everything so that we can serve and follow you. Isn't it reasonable that the two of us your favorite disciples, of course, should get to have the honor of sitting next to you in your glory. Now, Jesus immediately turns down the offer by saying, you don't know what you're asking for in verse 38. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And they said, of course, well, we are able. Haven't they proven their worthiness over the last couple years of service by following him around on foot, all the way around Galilee and up to Tyre and Sidon and down to Jerusalem and back? Haven't they proven yet that they're able to carry the weight that he would place upon their shoulders? And he says in verse 39, the cup that I drink, you shall drink, that cup of martyrdom, the cup of death. You will drink that cup. You shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But he does say in verse 40, to sit on my right or on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. But that's not the only thing we want to notice from this story. As we notice in the very next verse, in verse 41, when the other disciples heard this conversation transpiring, what was their attitude? Maybe toward Jesus a little bit, but for the most part toward the sons of Zebedee. It says that the 10 began to feel indignant with James and John. And I will posit here that any twisted view of greatness that we have in our minds will only produce strife, arrogance, and presumption, just as it does here in Mark chapter 10. When your idea of greatness is not calibrated correctly, you will not produce in your life a truly great life. It'll be twisted. It won't work. It'll be strange to those who have a truly great mind by God's standards. That's what greatness does. That's what greatness does. Greatness ruins people, at least worldly greatness. It twists them. It confuses them. He goes on to give this description of greatness by the world's standards, that the Gentiles have their own standard of greatness that they foist upon us and upon their servants. He says, beginning in verse 42, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. He says they're great men. He's not pulling any punches or trying to hide anything. He says the world thinks they're great. By their standard, by their definition, they're great. And their great men exercise authority over them. That's the way the world sees greatness. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the lesson. But he says, it is not so among you. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave to all. For he says in verse 45 that even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Looking for your definition of greatness in the world around you, in celebrities, in great politicians, in the accomplished academics of the world, will only result in the same vanity that enslaves them. If you want to be great like the Gentiles, you're going to end up like the Gentiles. If you want to be great like the celebrities, you're going to end up like the celebrities. If you want to be great like the politicians, you're going to end up just like the politicians. If you want to be great like them, you're going to end up just like them. Now here's where the lesson gets very practical. One writer put it very, very well. In his commentary on the book of Matthew, Fowler says, in short, there are no ringside seats for honored spectators in God's kingdom, just places of service down beside the king himself, who is busy washing feet, mediating for others, and dying for sinners. Now, I want to be a great person. I'll admit it. Excuse me. I want to be a great person. But the problem is that you've got a greatness paradox that Jesus is presenting here. That to be great, you have to learn to be the least. To be master, you have to learn how to be the servant first. To be the first one, You have to learn what it's like to be last more than anything else. It's a greatness paradox, so to speak. Our world believes greatness is just this very, very plain and simple subject. To be great, you've got to be great. To be least, you've got to be least. And it's so cut and dry, so black and white to the world. And Jesus says, it's not like that. It's not so among you. Twist your thinking around the other way. Flip it upside down, and you'll learn what it means to be truly great. Because not even the Son of Man, speaking of himself, not even the Son of Man came to be served. Not even the Son of Man came to lord it over people, to exercise a Gentile-like authority over the people around him. So I'll admit it, I want to be a great preacher. You know, we all have these different aspects, different components of ourselves. How do you define yourself? Think about your own life. How do you define yourself? Usually it's by your job or the fact that you're a father or mother, sister, brother, child. We have all these definitions, and we want to be great in those things. Admit it, you want to be great. Even if you're playing basketball on a Monday night rec league team, there's something about being human that makes it that you want to be the best at it. You want to win, don't you? You want to win the great tournament where like 12 people are sitting in the stands watching. You want to win the rec league tournament, don't you? If you're going to practice a hobby, don't you want to be good at it? Nobody gets into model building and makes a great big gloppy mess all over the place and says, it's good enough for me, probably. We want to be great at the things that we do. It's built into us. It's human nature. And I'll tell you, there's nothing wrong with it. I want to be a great preacher. And I want to be a great Christian. I don't want people to think I'm just ho-hum, good enough. Yeah, but finding another preacher would be such a hassle. We could live with Ryan for a little while. At least we get to hear Alan every couple weeks or so. No, I don't want to be that kind of preacher. I don't want to be that kind of Christian either. I don't want to be a great husband. I want to be a really, really great husband. Not because I'm arrogant or egotistical, but because at the end of our lives together, I want Rebecca to look back and feel really satisfied that she made the right choice all those years ago. I don't want it to be like when we eat at like Chili's or something. You know when you eat at a place like Chili's? You go and you're like, yeah, technically I've eaten food, I guess. You know, it was okay. I don't want our marriage, I don't want her to look back and go like, well, you know, he was okay. Technically speaking, he did everything he was supposed to as a husband. He was an average, decent, suitable husband. Now, I want to be a really great husband. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. To be motivated to be great in the things you do. And I want to be a great dad too. Just like with everything else, I don't want my kids to look back and go, you know, dad was okay. He was fine. He wasn't the worst dad in the world. We'll put it that way. I want to be a great dad. I want to be great at all the things that I do. And again, it's not because I'm egotistical. It's because it's built into us. We want to excel at the things that we care about, the things that truly matter to us. And being a great Christian and being a great parent and being a great spouse, those are things that matter. But Jesus says, if I want to be truly great, I have to learn how to be the least. If I want to be the first, I have to learn what it's like to be the last. If I want to be the master, I have to learn to be the servant. One thing I want to point out, in our story in Mark 10 that we read, Jesus never says the desire to be great is a bad thing. He never says it's a bad thing or that it's wrong or sinful. He says, whoever wishes to become great. That's not an indictment of the desire to be greatness. He's simply saying, if you want to be great, if you wish to be great, let me tell you how you're going to go about doing it. Because it's not like the Gentiles. It's different than what the Gentiles suggest. I'll give you another story here out of the life of Jesus that illustrates what we're talking about. Go to John chapter 13. And we know that in the first part of this chapter, in John chapter 13, Jesus has worn the clothes of a servant, a humble slave, and he's gone from one apostle to another, washing their feet. Just about the lowest job that one can do in a household. Because keep in mind, we're not talking about tidy, clean feet that have been kept in shoes all day long. We're talking about feet in sandals. walking in dust everywhere they go. This is a dirty job. And here's Jesus, stripped down to servant's clothes, doing a dirty job to his disciples. And in all of this, did he lose any of his lordship? Did he lose any of what made him great? He says, no. Look what he says beginning in verse 12. Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you're right, for so I am. And I like that point. Just because I stripped down to servant's clothes and washed your feet didn't change the fact that I'm the teacher and the Lord. I am still the Lord when I'm washing feet. What I do in service does not change who I am as the teacher and the Lord. You are right for calling me teacher and Lord, because that is exactly who I am. If I then, he says in verse 14, the Lord and the teacher, washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I gave you an example that you also should do as I did to you. Truly, truly, I say to you in verse 16, a slave is not greater than his master, neither is one who is sent greater than the one who sent him. And if you know these things, you're blessed if you do them. Achieving greatness is not a bad thing. It's the how and the why that can cause people trouble. We want to be great, don't we? We want to be great. But we have to know what our attitude is and what our motivation is and how it is we're going to go about that greatness. Jesus became great not because he shot people with lasers out of his eyes, which, quite frankly, he is the Son of God. If he had wanted to shoot lasers out of his eyes, he could have. If he had wanted to call 10,000 angels to his aid at any moment, he could have had legions of angels at his disposal. He could have destroyed every one of his enemies just with the wink of an eye. But he didn't. He didn't. Instead, he let his enemies spit on his face. He let the pagans nail him to a cross. He watched as all of his disciples ran away from him in terror, abandoning him in his moment of need. He watched his mother weep because her son was dying a death that he didn't deserve. He did all of that, and he never lost his greatness. Never lost it. In fact, it was because of those things that he did that he proved just how great he was. So sure, if I want to be a great Christian or a great preacher, I'm going to have to go about it a way that might not be expected. I could connive and I could scheme, and I could work my way up the ladder and find myself in a 20,000 seat stadium talking on TV every night. But I won't be a great preacher, and I won't be a great Christian. And I could be a really, really great husband, and I could tell my wife all the time just what a great husband is, and I could beat her down and tell her how awful she is by comparison, and at the end of the day, she could feel like trash because her awesome husband is just too good for her. And I could make my kids know how great I am, and every time my kids don't get an A+, I could tell them, well, I got an A+ on that test. And every time my kids don't beat me at basketball because I tower over them, I could make them feel horrible about it. And when my kids don't win a state championship because I won a state championship, and come on, your old man could do it, I could make my kids know how great I am, and they could feel like trash because of it. But you know what? I'd not be a great Christian, and I wouldn't be a great husband, and I wouldn't be a great father, because I'm going about it the wrong way. Austin Johnson once said, right there, that sometimes it's easier to define something by what it's not than what it is. Maybe I think that's true of greatness as well. Maybe if we look at greatness based on what it's not, like look at the life of a person who's not great, maybe we'll know a little bit more about what greatness is. Let's go to the book of Job. Job discovered a thing or two about the meaning of greatness in his journey from poverty from prosperity to poverty and eventually back again. So please turn to Job 31. I believe that Job gives us a very, very suitable definition what greatness is not. Remember that he saw life through the eyes at one point of a healthy, wealthy, happy family man, a man who was a heavy hitter for his time, who was a valuable member of society, who everybody around him probably considered to be a great man by the world's standards. And then he experienced life as a worthless nobody, rejected by everybody, including his wife, except for three friends who were not particularly comforting during his time of greatest need. So Job knew what it was like to be great, and he knew what it was like to be a nobody. And he has some perspective to offer us here. I'd like to go through a few things here in Job 31. If you'd like to follow along, please notice, beginning in verse 1, "I have made a covenant with my eyes," he says in Job 31. "How then could I gaze at a virgin? And what is the portion of God from above, or the heritage of the Almighty from on high? Is it not calamity to the unjust and disaster to those who work iniquity? Does he not see my ways and number my steps?" Skip on down to verse 9. "If my heart has been enticed by a woman, if I've lurked at my neighbor's doorway and my wife grind for another, and let others kneel down over her, for that would be a lustful crime," he says. "Moreover, it would be an iniquity punishable by judges, for it would be fire that consumes to Abaddon and would uproot all my increase." One thing that our world says is great about people, especially men, more men than anything else, is all the sexual conquests that we've had in life. "I can be great because I lived the life of James Bond. I'm great because I'm handsome. I'm rich. I can do whatever I want. I'm the 50 shades of gray in bodily form, my friends. I am great because of the people that I've taken down. I'm great because of the people I've dated, because I've dated a celebrity, or I've dated somebody rich, or I've dated somebody who's popular or who has image. And I'm great because of the sexual exploits of my life." You know what Job says? Job says, "I cannot be a great person by that standard. I can't be a great person by that standard, because such a life would be punishable by the judges. That is a life that is reserved for hell itself. I could not be great." And yet our world loves that stuff. The locker room talk. Our world talks about greatness in that context all the time. You can't be great by that standard. Well, he goes on to say here in the next passage in verses 5 through 8, "If I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened after deceit, let him weigh me with accurate scales and let God know my integrity. If my step is turned from the way, or my heart followed my eyes, or if any spot is stuck to my hands, let me sow and another eat, and let my crops be uprooted." What he's basically saying is, can greatness be found in dishonesty? Dishonesty, after all, is a hallmark of good business sense. Everybody knows that, right? You can't move up the corporate ladder by being a good, honest man. Sadly, my dad learned that the hard way. Good guys, just, you know, when you're not willing to rub the elbows and grease the palms of all the wrong people, you just don't get the promotion. You don't get to move up. You don't get the big pay raise. Now, I know that's not always the case. It's not always the case. And I'm not saying at all that Christians shouldn't try to move up in the world and do what's right and be honest and have a good, honest business sense. But I'll say, by the world's standard of greatness, most of the great people of the world got there because of dishonesty. They got there because when the choice came down to, I can be honest and be punished for it, or I can be dishonest and be rewarded for it, most people know exactly which one they're going to choose. And again, Job was an honest man, and he became a great man because of his honesty. His integrity followed him. He says, "Lord, you know my integrity." So I'm not saying it's impossible or that you shouldn't try or get the promotion or anything like that. I'm just saying, be careful that that doesn't become your standard of greatness. That your greatness is not measured by how great you are in your job or your social status. Because sometimes those things, the job and the social status, come with a really, really hefty cost that the Christian should not be willing to pay. He says, beginning in verse 13, "If I have despised the claim of my male or female servants when they filed a complaint against me, what then could I do when God arises? When he calls me to account, what will I answer to him? Did not he who made me in the womb make him? the same one fashion us in the womb? Often worldly greatness is found by stepping on the little people around you. But you got that way because you stepped on the backs of the people around you. It's a me-first attitude. It's a dog-eat-dog world. It's the world of sharks and predators. Job, however, and I like this, Job listened to his servants. Job was not great because he stepped on his servants. Job was great because he listened to them. He said, when they filed a complaint against me, did I not listen? God knows that I listened, that I cared about what my male and female servants had to think about me, what they had to say about me. I cared about that. You can become great by the world's standards by destroying the people around you. But you can become great in God's eyes by caring what people think, by caring when you step on somebody else and apologizing and not moving up the world because of things like that. Verse 16. If I have kept the poor from their desire, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the orphan has not shared it, but from my youth he grew up with me as with a father, and from infancy I guided her. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or that the needy had no covering, if his loins have not thanked me, if he has not been warmed at the fleece of my sheep, if I have lifted up my hand against the orphan because I saw I had support in the gate, let my shoulder fall from the socket, and my arm be broken off at the elbow, for calamity from God is a terror to me. Because of his majesty, I can do nothing. Great people of the world often become that way because of this me-first attitude. They may help the poor, but only when the cameras are watching. They may donate to charity only if a tax break is involved in it. Wealth, after all, according to the logic of the world, wealth is never accumulated by giving it to homeless people. Right? Ebenezer Scrooge knew that, didn't he? After all, hey, homeless people should just go get a job. You're never accumulating wealth if you're supporting orphans. Orphans are just a drain on society. Or by wasting time reaching out to lonely people. They're probably just lonely for a reason, you know. They should go make some friends themselves. Job understood that there was a spiritual price to pay, though. When you cut off in your life everyone who has need, there is a spiritual price to pay. So maybe you get to keep the money in your pocket. Maybe instead of giving to the needy person, you get to keep it for yourself and spend it on your pleasures. But there's a spiritual price that you pay when you cut people out of your life like that. True greatness is manifested in getting your hands dirty in people's lives, in hearing children laughing, in a kind embrace for the person who's hurting, and maybe every now and then helping that homeless person instead of ridiculing them. In verse 24, if I have put my confidence in gold and called fine gold my trust, if I've gloated because my wealth was great and because my hand had secured so much, if I've looked at the sun when it shone or the moon glowing in splendor, and my heart became secretly enticed and my hand threw a kiss from my mouth, that too, he says, would have been an iniquity, calling for judgment, for I would have denied God above. Am I great because of my bank account? I like actually the way Job puts it. He says, that would have been like denying God above. That reminds me of Proverbs chapter 30. In Proverbs 30, the writer of Proverbs, at least Proverbs 30, asks God for a favor. He says, beginning in verse 7, two things I ask of thee. Don't refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? That's the same thing Job is saying, isn't it? If I have trusted in my gold, if I've made gold the meaning of my life, that's tantamount to denying God. That's the same thing as saying, who's God? Who needs God? What do I need God for in my life when I've got a full bank account, when I'm surrounded by wealth and opulence? Who needs God? And there's a lot of great people in the world who have a great big bank account and a great big house, and they're not great in God's eyes. Now, it's not that the money itself is the problem. It's as Job puts it, is that my confidence? Is that my trust? Is that where I believe my greatness comes from? 29 and 30. Have I rejoiced at the extinction of my enemy or exalted when evil befell me? No. I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for his life in a curse. Perhaps greatness is then defined by how we treat our enemies. Do we kick them when they're down? Do we rub defeat into their faces and kick dust into their eyes? Job says, no, I could never become great like that. I could never achieve greatness by asking for the defeat of my enemy, by kicking him when he's down, by gloating in his face when I know that he's failed at something. Jesus himself said in his Sermon on the Mount, when you do have enemies, and we will have enemies in this life, you don't get even with them. You don't get your own revenge, but you love your enemies. And pray for your enemies. You turn the other cheek. You give him another garment when he asks for one. When he asks you to go 1 mile, you go 2. You love your enemies. Paul said the same thing in Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21. As far as it depends on you, be at peace with all people. Don't take your own vengeance. Leave room for the wrath of God. Instead of taking your own vengeance on your enemies, do good to them. Feed them when they're hungry. Give them something to drink when they're thirsty. You'll show what kind of person you are, how great you are, when you treat your enemies in that way. The last passage here, verses 33 and 34. Have I covered my transgressions like Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom? Because I feared the great multitude, and the contempt of families terrified me, and I kept silent and did not go out of doors. Sometimes the world believes that greatness is found in having this infallible image, by looking good, looking young, looking rich, looking perfect, never making any mistakes. And we're so scared, like Job says, we're so scared that somebody will find out that we have a flaw. We're so scared that somebody will find out that we're not perfect, that we hide indoors, that we run away from people, that we keep people out, that we put up this image, this facade of infallibility. No, you can't be great like that. You can never be great like that. And you know what? We can't make fun of Joan Rivers anymore because she died too. You can put all the plastic surgery on and cover yourself in the makeup and cover yourself with expensive clothes and live in a big house. And you can have an image consultant. And you can have people scrub your internet history. You can have people edit your biography to keep all the ugly things out. You can try as hard as you can to make people believe that you are perfect and plastic. But you can never be. And actually, Job says, true greatness is found in being honest about yourself. Being honest about your sin. Being honest about the iniquities that you've committed. Question then. We love to have this air of infallibility about us, don't we? Are you honest with God about the sins that you've committed? Are you honest with other Christians? Are you really honest about yourself? Maybe that's all part of learning to be great by learning to be least, by learning to be first by being last, being master by being servant. Maybe when we learn just how low we actually are spiritually, just how sinful we really are, how Romans 3, verse 23, we actually are in life. Maybe once we learn that, we can learn what it's like to be great. Learn to be last, and you'll be first. Be honest about sin. In short, Job's greatness was defined by his private character, what God saw of him on the inside, rather than public image, and what people saw of him on the outside. We'll end our lesson with this. A brief look at the greatest person ever. You want to talk about greatness? Well, you can't talk about greatness without mentioning John the Baptist. Jesus himself said in Matthew 11 and verse 11, that of all men who are born of women, there has not arisen anyone greater than John the Baptist. He then has got to be the benchmark for greatness in our lives. A man who wore camel skins and wandered about the wilderness, basically like a vagabond, who ate locusts and honey, who had his head chopped off by Herod. You mean he's the greatest born of women? You mean he's the benchmark for greatness? Let's look a little bit about John's life. Go to John chapter 3. And notice in the Gospel of John, in chapter 3, we'll call this the moment that John the Baptist realized that he was in decline. The moment that John the Baptist knew for certain that he was going to be waning as Jesus was waxing. In verse 25, there arose therefore a discussion on the part of John's disciples with a Jew about purification. And in verse 26, they came to John the Baptist and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have borne witness, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. And at this point, a lot of worldly great people might look at that. They'll look at the attendance figures. They'll look at the money coming in. They'll look at the numbers and the statistics, and they'll go, uh-oh, what are we doing wrong? Uh-oh. Uh-oh, the followers of John the Baptist are abandoning him. And they might feel like their greatness is beginning to falter. And yet look at John's gracious response. A man can receive nothing unless it has been given him from heaven. You yourselves bear witness that I said I am not the Christ, but that I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. And so this joy of mine has been made full. And look what he says in verse 30. He must increase, but I must decrease. That's greatness personified. That is the greatest man ever born of women up until the point of the kingdom of God coming into the world. And this great man is saying, I am okay with decreasing. If Jesus is the one benefiting from my decrease, I am okay decreasing. I'm okay being the last. I'm okay being relegated to the back of the line. I'm okay being overshadowed and overtaken as long as it's by Jesus. As long as it is the Son of God who has come to this world to save sinners, I'm okay with that. Because he learned how to be last, Jesus says he is first. Because he learned how to be least, Jesus calls him the greatest. What is your attitude? We have John the Baptist accepting his declining popularity and being okay with it. We have Jesus, the Son of God, the Lord, the Master, the Teacher, washing his disciples' feet and saying, I've given you an example that you should follow. We have Job, dirt poor, covered in scabs, giving his own definition of greatness. The lowest people, by the world's standards, knew what it was to be great. Do you? Maybe it's time to recalibrate that definition. Start thinking about greatness in a whole new way. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. This is your opportunity to become a Christian, to hear a message of salvation, the gospel, which is the good news, to believe in that message, to repent of all the sins that you've committed, to change your life, to confess that belief in Jesus Christ, and to be baptized so that you can live a life for Him from this day forward. Whatever need you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.